readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I just returned from an incredible trip to Italy, the Cinque Terre, and the south of France. Magnifico! Europe is a great destination for summer travels, but then it's great to be heading out anywhere. I'm sure many of you are dusting off your passports during the summer months, so without any reservations, may I present The Book Report's travel show. We'll be previewing books that cover lots of ground. And I've got a great guest who will help you navigate through the wide world of travel guides and suggest some destination and trip ideas you may not have considered. So, all aboard, this train is leaving the station.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Holy Cow, an Indian Adventure, during a three-week trip to India a few short years ago. I loved it. I felt it got a mind-blowingly, is that a word? Complex country so very right. So, if India is on your bucket list, here's a classic you should pick up. After backpacking her way around India, Sarah McDonald decided she hated the country with a passion. When a beggar at the airport read her palm and insisted she would return one day, and for love, she screamed, "Never!" and gave the country and him the finger. But 11 years later, the prophecy came true. When the love of Sarah's life is posted to India, she quits her dream job as a national radio presenter to follow him to overcrowded, completely crazy New Delhi. It seems like the ultimate sacrifice for love, and it almost kills her, literally. Often hilarious, sometimes hair-raising, and always entertaining, Holy Cow is a roller coaster ride through a land of chaos and contradiction, from spiritual retreats and crumbling nirvanas to war zones and New Delhi nightclubs. Holy Cow is also a very skilled look at a wide variety of India's religions, saints, and spiritual practices. And the narrator, Kate Hoskin, has a great way with accents. Listen, you'll see what I mean.
As we take off, I give smog-swirled New Delhi the finger. Goodbye and good riddance, India. I hate you and I'm never, never, ever coming back. Chapter 1. Through the Looking Glass. I have a dreadful long-term memory. I only remember two traumatic events of my childhood. My brother's near death by drowning, and my own near-death by humiliation when I was rescued by a lifeguard while attempting my first lap of butterfly in the local pool. I vaguely remember truth or dare kisses in the back of a bus, aged about 12, dancing to My Sharona at 13, behaving like an absolute asshole in my adolescence, and having a hideous hippie phase involving dreadlocks and tie-dye when I was at university. For my 21st birthday, my parents gave me a plane ticket and a blessing to leave home in Australia for a year. This middle-class rite of passage had become a family tradition. My mother had hitchhiked around Europe in the 50s and wanted us all to experience the joy of travel before we settled into careers. My trip through Europe, Egypt and Turkey is a bit of a blur, and recollections of the two-month tour of India on the way home are vague. I can see myself roadside squatting and peeing with women in wonderful saris, sunset games of beach cricket with a trinity of fat Goan men named Jesus, Joseph and Jude, and the white bright teeth of a child rickshaw driver wearing a T-shirt printed with, "Come on Aussie, come on." I recall angst, incredible anger, deep depression, and a love-hate relationship with the country, but I can't remember why. I'd filed the soothsayer, his prophecies and my vow never to return under young stupid rubbish, and let it fall deep into the black hole of my brain. Until now, a month short of 11 years later. As I walk into the plane in Singapore, a seed starts to sprout in the blocked sewer of my memory. A seed watered by the essence of stale urine and the whiff of vomit coming from my window seat, where the pink and orange paisley wallpaper artfully camouflages the spew. The high-pitched, highly excited jumble of Indian voices almost germinates a recollection. But after too many going-away parties involving too much indulgence, I'm too wasted to let the bud bloom. I fall asleep. Somewhere over Chennai, I become aware of an increasingly rhythmic prodding of my inner thigh by something long, thin and hard. I open my eyes to see a brown finger with a long curved nail closing in on my crotch. The digit is attached to a scrawny old Sikh in a turban sitting beside me. He is slobbering and shaking with excitement. I'm too sleepy, shocked, and for some reason too embarrassed to scream, so I buzz for sisterly assistance. An air hostess with big hair, long nails and drag queen makeup slowly strolls over. She looks cranky. What? This man is touching me when I sleep? I bleat indignantly. The hostess rolls her eyes and waggles her finger. At me? Well, stay awake and don't let it happen again, madam. She wheels on the spot and strides off, swishing her nylon sari. Months later, a friend will tell me that many Indian trolley dollies are rich girls whose parents pay a massive bribe to get them a job involving travel and five-star hotels. These brats view passengers as pesky intrusions way beneath their status and detest doing the job of a high-flying servant. But right now, I'm floored, abandoned, and angry. I stay wide awake and alert until a hostess with a mostess sprays the cabin with foul-smelling insecticide. She aims an extra jet directly at my head. I can almost hear her thinking, "Slut germs, no returns." It's now that I remember that India is like Wonderland. In this other universe, everyone seems mad and everything is upside down, back to front, and infuriatingly bizarre. I'm Alice. Fuzzy with feelings about my previous trip down the rabbit hole, I'm now flying straight back through the looking glass to a place where women are blamed for sleazy men and planes are sprayed when they fly from a clean city to a dirty one. In this world, we applaud a dreadful landing that's as fast and steep as a takeoff. We jump up and tackle fellow passengers in a scrum at the door while the plane is still moving, and the air hostess gets off first. I get off last to be embraced by the cold and clammy smog, the cocktail of damp diesel, swirling dust, burning cow dung, toxic chemicals, spicy sweat and sandalwood wraps me in memories. The soothsayer and his prophecies of a decade ago boil to the surface of my brain. For the old bloke did give a good handjob. My friend Nick got married soon after we came home. She then quickly popped out two gorgeous girls and has never come back to India. I'm still single, and at 33, by Indian standards, I'm a spinster to be pitied. I've had good jobbing. Only days ago I finished my last morning show on the Triple J network. I've interviewed famous actors, crazed celebrities, and brilliant musicians. I've talked with an audience I admire, and I've enjoyed a lifestyle of travelling, film premieres, theatre opening nights, music gigs, and festivals. I've left the best job in the world for a country that I now remember hating with a passion, and I've done it for love. My boyfriend Jonathan is the ABC's South Asia correspondent based in New Delhi, and after a year of yearning, soppy love songs and pathetic phone calls, we've decided we can't live apart. I look to see if the toilet cleaner is here to gloat.
Wooldridge is an award-winning travel and business journalist, entrepreneurial manager, and an innovator in multimedia content delivered via newspapers, magazines, online, and broadcast.
Currently, Jane is the Miami Herald's executive business editor, but for many years, Jane was the Herald's travel editor. Jane is a genuine travel fanatic. Between personal and business travel, she has visited more than 100 countries. She's been the winner of the Lowell Thomas Travel Journalist of the Year and has a long list of awards for her travel writing. Jane has a new book out for National Geographic, The 100 Best Affordable Vacations to Enrich Your Life. It's a great look at ways to satisfy your wanderlust without breaking the bank. The book features out-of-the-ordinary opportunities, wonderfully affordable, some are even free. Vacation categories include classic Americana, learning vacations, wilderness trips, mind, body, and soul-themed getaways. With this mix, there are lots of creative ideas and destinations for one and all, whatever your interest, schedule, or budget. Jane also offers lively sidebars about off-season travel, how to be a traveler and not a tourist. Jane has appeared on The Today Show, The Travel Channel, and on radio shows for Peter Greenberg and Arthur Frommer. And here she is to speak with us today. Welcome, Jane. It's so great to have you with me today.
It's terrific to be here. Thanks.
So in this challenging economy, people are still traveling. How have itineraries changed?
Well, I think a lot of people are looking to do things that obviously are going to be a little closer to home, providing they're traveling with a group of people, though there are a lot of airfare sales on. So if you're traveling as a couple, people are still able to go pretty far afield. But primarily, it's a little bit shorter and a little bit closer to home.
Well, talking about airfare, it seems to me just casually that the airfares are going up, up, and away. So where do you look for these, you know, more affordable airfares?
Well, here's the secret. Airfares are going up and up, but all of the airlines are constantly doing these 24-hour flash sales. And so if there's an airline that you fly regularly, for instance, since I live in Miami, I'm often on American Airlines because they're a primary carrier here. I sign up for their alerts on fare sales. And you can also sign up for a service called smartertravel.com. And one of the great things about Smarter Travel is that they send you an email every week with different deals from your specific market. So that also helps you keep tab.
Oh, okay. That was smartertravel.com, right?
Smartertravel.com.
Okay.
And I'll give you an example. One of the things that I found is yesterday I was looking at airfares and thinking, oh, this is more than I want to pay. And then within 12 hours, I got an alert on my phone. It was actually from the airline specific that I'd signed up with. And it told me that they had a fare sale on. And lo and behold, I was able to get that fare for $100 cheaper.
Wow. Can you give us an insider's look at some places that you're writing about that are on the cusp of being discovered but are still relatively unspoiled?
Well, that's always a tough go. And there are a lot of places far afield that are sort of relatively undiscovered. So we always think about places in Latin America that haven't gotten huge mobs yet, or some places in Eastern Europe, particularly. Croatia's become pretty popular, but some of the places that are a bit north of there have become, you know, not as well known. Bosnia in particular is becoming sort of a new place to go that isn't well discovered. But I would say that here in the U.S., there are also a lot of places that maybe people don't know about, or experiences that people don't know about, that really are relatively affordable. And because they're not on your radar screen, you maybe don't think of going there, or you think it's something other than what it was or is today. So there are places closer to home worth discovering as well.
All right. So, okay, you walk into a bookstore, you go to the shelf, there's Frommer's Fodor, Lonely Planet, Eyewitness. How do you choose? And are some books geared more towards youth travel, budget travel? Where do you start?
Okay. One of the places that I think is always worth starting is a new category that's come up a bit in the last few years, and it's sort of, they call it travel. They still call them travel guides, but they're not really. They're books that are survey experiences. So you will find, for instance, one that I just was involved in writing, the 100 Best Affordable Vacations from National Geographic, but it's certainly not the only book in this category. You'll find a lot of things, the 100 Best Trips, the 100 Best suggest this. Everybody's heard of, you know, places to see before you die. And those are good surveys that might help you think about some places you didn't know about. Beyond that, when it goes to specific guides, I have personal opinions, having used most of them over the time. Most people think of Lonely Planet as being a guidebook series for younger or backpack travelers. And while that is still true, in recent years, Lonely Planet has made a real effort to include the more up-end and mid-range options for people who, okay, I'm a little beyond the backpacking thing myself. So Lonely Planet is a better guidebook, a more wide-ranging guidebook, I think, than it used to be. I like both Voters and Frommer's, but I think you've got to look at each book because each one's written by a different author. So you want to kind of look at the author in the front. I have to tell you that many people love the eyewitness guides, but I tried to use one recently on a trip, and one of the things that I was reminded of is that while they have great graphics, they're really not deep on information. And so when I wanted more historical background about, I happened to be in India, it just didn't give me as much as I wanted. So I think from a graphic standpoint, they're very appealing, but if you're one of those people like I am who want a little background on the place, probably doesn't work as well for you.
All right. In your book, The 100 Best Affordable Vacations, talk a little bit about learning vacations, because I think that's certainly a rising category, and I think people may not know where to go to find out about these.
Well, learning vacations have been pretty much all the rage in the last couple of years, and there are a variety of different kinds of learning vacations. There are ones that are put out by the company that used to be called Elder Hostel, and that doesn't mean you have to be ancient to qualify, but that in fact it's pretty much the AARP range, which I think is now, isn't 60 the new 40? So it's 50 and over, and it's called Rhodes Scholar, and they have a lot of different kinds of learning vacations. But beyond that, there are other places that do as well. Many universities offer summer courses. Some of them are short and some of them are long, that are geared toward, you know, learning a new skill. They're also So one of the things I was just entranced by and sort of put on my own bucket list is a number of craft schools around the country that you can go and learn to make paper beads, or you can go and learn to make brooms. There are a lot of different kinds of scenarios there. There's one that's a wooden boat school, and I have to confess that this had not been something that hit my own radar screen, but my husband went to it with a buddy, and they just thought that this was a great experience. So there's a kind of learning vacation for whoever you are in your specific niche, and they are surprisingly affordable. I thought these things would be, you know, bank breakers, but they're really not.
All right. Well, in addition to TripAdvisor, which online user-generated content sites do you like and do you trust?
Well, TripAdvisor is a plus-minus scenario, as you may know. On the one hand, it has a lot of different reviews, and that's always a good thing, but those reviews are not pre-vetted. They are not necessarily written by people who've actually stayed in the place they're writing about. So sometimes you do get the, you know, sister-in-law effect, even though they try very hard not to let that happen, or the disgruntled, cranky person who gets all their friends to write. And my advice on TripAdvisor itself is, if it has a lot of different reviews on a property, that makes it more trustworthy, because you're going to have, you know, 500 people weighing in.
Yeah.
But if there are only a handful of reviews, I'm a bit more cautious. For that reason, I tend to go toward the reviews that are on hotels.com and other booking sites like that. And the reason is that in order to post a review on any of those sites, you must have actually booked and stayed in the hotel through that company. So hotels.com, someplace like Expedia and Travelocity, any of those sites require you to have actually booked through them to then post a review. And I'm more comfortable with that, and I think that the trustworthy factor with that is higher. But again, it's always worth bearing in mind that people who post reviews are often people who did not like something. And you always need to take that with a grain of salt.
That's really good advice. All right, let's say that you're on vacation and you're in one of the cities. What apps do you like for advice? I mean, I use Yelp when I'm traveling in the U.S. and so on. But are there others that, okay, you're in San Francisco and you want the best Asian restaurant? I mean, what do you recommend?
Well, I think, again, the sites that have widespread acceptance, like Yelp, are good places to go. TripAdvisor is a good place to go. Zagat's is a good place to go. But beyond that, increasingly what you're seeing is more and more guidebooks come out on apps. And some of them are app-only, some of them are in print. But there, you know, for $1.99, you can take a look and see what somebody who's a professional journalist, who, if they've done their job well, have looked at a lot of different restaurants, a lot of different hotels, and have gone out and experienced those things. And those are good places to look. Sutro Media publishes a lot of those. You wouldn't probably know it's called Sutro Media, but you could go and look there and see what apps are out there. But I think it's the same, you know, in terms of user reviews, it's the same sites that you're accustomed to using on a computer, or on a tablet. You're also going to be using them on a smartphone.
Oh, all right. Now, in your book, you give some tips about how to be a traveler and not a tourist. Can you share some of those?
Well, sure. I think we've all been tourists, no question about it, and it's not a bad thing either. But being a tourist means you probably have gone and looked at something. You walk in the door of the museum, you stare at the painting on the wall, and don't get me wrong, I'm a big museum fan, but you go in and you just kind of look at things, you don't partake. And one of the ways you become more of a traveler, one of it is just taking time to wander around a place, to go to the places local people go, and in fact, talk to local people. So you want to go to the best pie shop in the town and just chat up the people. You can get engaged by doing something like a rebuilding together project, something that puts you a little bit closer in touch with the place itself. But my number one piece of advice, and I think anybody who has you know, done a lot of traveling, is to get off the beaten path and take time. Don't be so overscheduled that all you have time to be is a tourist. Hmm. To be a traveler, you need just a little bit more time, and that doesn't mean you have to take an extra week. My co-author on the book, Larry Blyberg, used to have a rule that when he was traveling on business, he would schedule in an afternoon where he literally put on his schedule, "Just get lost." And by doing that, he would go and wander, and I've done the same thing, and you end up in that little local whatever it is, or you ask for the recommendation of the local person, and you end up someplace you never knew you were going to go, and it gives you a real sense of the people of a place, because that's what places are. They're really about the people.
So when you're scheduling or kind of planning out your, for example, European itinerary, mm-hmm. when you're talking about a major capital, how many days should you really devote? I mean, and what's your opinion on that?
Well, I would say that many places sort of add up to me like this. They're either good for 3 days or they're good for 3 months. And what happens for me is that you can do the surface of a place rather quickly. And if that's what you've got to give that place, I would say a minimum of 3 days. But there's some places that after 3 days, you really sort of wear out on them unless you've got a lot more time to give them. I think any European capital, you know, you can easily spend a week if you consider that part of what you're going to be doing with that time is wandering, is sitting in the patisserie, and is taking day trips out of that capital so that you've got some extra time. But it also depends on who you're traveling with. If you're traveling with kids who are going to need to, you know, take an afternoon break, if you're traveling with an older adult who's going to need an afternoon nap, or even I might need an afternoon nap because I'm jet lagged, then you add a couple of extra days. But I think 3 days is the absolute minimum. Even places I've gone to, and there are places I've gone to dozens and dozens of times, I still don't give it less than 3 days.
Hmm. All right. Now, here's a question I want to ask as a parent of college-age kids. Back in the day, it was Europe on $5 and $10 a day. If you're sending your kid off for a summer vacation in Europe and they're backpacking and they've already purchased their Eurail pass, how much should they budget? And they're doing hostels, let's say that, or, you know, reasonable lodgings. How much should they go in there with it for a daily, you know, budget? What should they have in their pockets?
Well, I think they're going to have to. It depends on where exactly they're going because the exchange rates are a big issue.
Yeah.
But I think you are going to need to have a minimum of $50 a day in your pocket. If you're talking about food, lodging, you've already got that year rail pass, but if you're going to go to a museum, although I have to say that museums and many attractions have free or student prices in Europe, and one of the things you should really do if you're a student traveling is make sure you have a student ID because you can get free into a lot of places. You're still going to, though, want to buy, you know, some entries, some attractions, and I think 35 to 50 is going to be your absolute bare minimum.
All right. So, okay, now I know that your book is available through the National Geographic website, but where else can we find it?
You can find it in many local bookstores, wherever local is for you, and they definitely have it on Amazon, and they do have it on Kindle.
Oh, all right. Well, thank you so much, Jane. Is this, your book is really valuable tool, and I think before you head off on your summer vacation, you might want to check it out. Thank you, Jane.
Thank you. You have a great day.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Where have I been all my life, and what have I been reading? Prior to researching this edition of the Book Report, I had never heard of J. Martin Troust. What a hoot! Getting Stoned with Savages, a trip through the islands of Fiji and Vanuatu, reveals Troust's wry wit and infectious joy of discovery in a hilarious account of life in the farthest reaches of the world. After two grueling years on the island of Tarawa, Troust was in no hurry to return to the South Pacific. Until he began to feel remarkably out of place in modern America. He knew it was time to set off again for parts unknown. Here he tells the story of his time on Vanuatu, a cluster of islands where he struggles against typhoons, earthquakes, and giant centipedes, but finds himself swept up in the laid-back, clothing-optional lifestyle of the islanders. When his wife Sylvia gets pregnant, they decamp for slightly more civilized Fiji, a fallen paradise rife with prostitutes and government coups, and they take quite naturally to island living. This title is read by one of my faves, Simon Vance. Let's listen.
Huddled on the subway, I lingered on the image for a moment, far away, envisioning the canopy of palm trees swaying in the near distance, the urgent leap of a flying fish, the fishermen in sailing canoes returning with their catch, the brilliant shimmering colours offered by a setting sun, until my reverie came to an abrupt end as the subway doors opened, and I was swept into the tumult of the rush-hour commute. It was a disconcerting sensation. Blue. Blue water, I thought in vain, as I was shepherded onto an escalator crowded with pasty-faced suits like myself, dejected already. I tried imagining swaying palm trees as I scurried through the rain toward my office at the World Bank, flashing the colour-coded ID card I kept tethered to my belt. Inside, I tried conjuring stress-free tropical living, once I found on my chair a dreaded note from my boss, "Please see me, 7:45 a.m. But the image was gone. Poof. How had this happened? I wondered again. For 2 years I had lived in Kiribati, a widely dispersed scattering of atolls at the end of the world, where I had led a rather lively and adventurous existence with my girlfriend Sylvia. And now I was right back where I started, in the real world, as some prefer to call it, wondering how I might leave it again. As I settled into my office, I noticed another note on top of my keyboard, scrawled by the office assistant. IFC meeting in WBIGF conference room. Where are you? 8:21 a.m. The message light on my phone blinked ominously. Sighing, I loped toward the conference room, pausing briefly to catch sight of my reflection in the window, and I noted with some interest that I looked like sodden vermin. It was not going to be a good day, I knew. The conference room itself was transparent, because the World Bank values transparency, and as I approached I wondered, is that a bank vice president sitting there? Why, yes, it was. Is that another one? Indeed so. And look, there's our division chief. Does he ever look pissed off? I entered, and as I mumbled my apologies, my boss cut me off. Finally, he said, now we can begin. Do you have the PowerPoint slides? The PowerPoint slides? Was that me? I thought, wasn't Sergio? Sergio looked upon me with serene blankness. I dampened a little further, as the perspiration commingled with the rain, and as I studied the multitude of agitated faces, I thought to myself, 6 months ago. Inexplicably, 6 months turned into a year, and then two. Yet that strange sense of dislocation never left me. Where am I? I'd asked myself with alarming frequency. How did I get here? What events in time and space have brought me to this moment? Glancing out my office window, I'd see limousines depositing presidents and prime ministers, Nobel laureates and eminent thinkers, even Bono himself, and I'd remember that not so long ago I had lived in a place that could not possibly be further removed from the global stage. In Kiribati, I would gladly have given up a finger or two for a newspaper, and now here I was, surrounded by newsworthy personalities. Even my friends thought my change in circumstances odd. The World Bank? You? You're a hoity-toity consultant to the World Bank? Asked one. Yes. You were unemployed for 2 years, and now you've got this glam job at the World Bank? I wasn't unemployed, I countered, pleased to hear someone describe my job as glamorous.
Readers, you know I strive for balance in all things. So, we're going to juxtapose some of these modern travel jaunts with classics worthy of your time and attention. Here's the first. I don't know how this happened, but I managed to get through high school and college without reading Travels with Charlie, In Search of America by John Steinbeck. According to the book's Facebook page, how's that for timely, Travels with Charlie recounts a 1960 cross-country road trip that Steinbeck took with his French poodle, Charlie. Steinbeck was moved by a desire to see his country on a personal level. He tells of traveling in a specially made camper he named Rocinante, after Don Quixote's horse. His travels start in Long Island and roughly follow the outer border of the U.S., from Maine to the Pacific Northwest, down to his native Salinas Valley, California, across to Texas, up through the Deep South, then back to New York. Steinbeck covered nearly 10,000 miles. According to Tom Steinbeck, the author's oldest son, the real reason for this trip may have been Steinbeck knew his end was near, and he wanted to see his country one last time. Moving through the woods and the forests, dirt tracks and highways to large city and wildernesses, Steinbeck observed America and the Americans with a humorous and sometimes skeptical eye. What he sees is a lonely, generous nation, too packed with individuals for single judgments. His vision of how the world was changing, however, speaks to us warningly and prophetically through the decades.
I knew the changes only from books and newspapers, but more than this, I had not felt the country for 25 years. In short, I was writing of something I did not know about, and it seems to me that in a so-called writer, this is criminal. My memories were distorted by 25 intervening years. Once, I traveled about in an old bakery wagon, double-doored rattler with a mattress on its floor. I stopped where people stopped or gathered. I listened and looked and felt, and in the process had a picture of my country, the accuracy of which was impaired only by my own shortcomings. So it was that I determined to look again, to try to rediscover this monster land. Otherwise, in writing, I could not tell the small diagnostic truths which are the foundations of the larger truth. One sharp difficulty presented itself. In the intervening 25 years, my name had become reasonably well known, and it has been my experience that when people have heard of you, favorably or not, they change. They become, through shyness or the other qualities that publicity inspires, something they are not under ordinary circumstances. This being so, my trip demanded that I leave my name and my identity at home. I had to be peripatetic eyes and ears, a kind of moving gelatin plate. I could not sign hotel registers, meet people I knew, interview others, or even ask searching questions. Furthermore, two or more people disturb the ecologic complex of an area. I had to go alone, and I had to be self-contained, a kind of casual turtle carrying his house on his back. With all this in mind, I wrote to the head office of a great corporation which manufactures trucks. I specified my purpose and my needs. I wanted a 3/4-ton pickup truck, capable of going anywhere under possibly rigorous conditions, and on this truck I wanted a little house built, like the cabin of a small boat. A trailer is difficult to maneuver on mountain roads. He is impossible and often illegal to park and is subject to many restrictions. In due time, specifications came through for a tough, fast, comfortable vehicle mounting a camper top, a little house with double bed, a four-burner stove, a heater, refrigerator, and lights operating on butane, a chemical toilet, closet space, storage space, windows screened against insects, exactly what I wanted. It was delivered in the summer to my little fishing place at Sag Harbor near the end of Long Island. Although I didn't want to start before Labor Day, when the nation settles back to normal living, I did want to get used to my turtle shell, to equip it, and learn it. It arrived in August, a beautiful thing, powerful and yet lithe. It was almost as easy to handle as a passenger car. And because my planned trip had aroused some satiric remarks among my friends, I named it Rocinante, which you will remember was the name of Don Quixote's horse. Since I made no secret of my project, a number of controversies arose among my friends and advisors. A projected journey spawns advisors in schools. I was told that since my photograph was as widely distributed as my publisher could make it, I would find it impossible to move about without being recognized. Let me say in advance that in over 10,000 miles in 34 states, I was not recognized even once. I believe that people identify things only in context. Even those people who might have known me against a background I am supposed to have in no case identified me in Rocinante.
Next, what do you get when you combine classic travel literature with the incomparable wit of Mark Twain? The Innocents Abroad, a keenly observant, politically incorrect, and often hilarious narration of the author's cruise to the Holy Land aboard a retired Civil War ship. First published in 1869 and the best-selling of Twain's works in his lifetime, The Innocents Abroad delights listeners with the celebrated author's musing on historic landmarks, cultural differences, and very silly traveling companions. Some readers say Robin Field channels Mark Twain with his folksy narration. You be the judge.
Novels and poetry in the shade of the smokestacks. Or watch for the jellyfish and the nautilus over the side. And the shark, the whale, and other strange monsters of the deep. And at night they were to dance in the open air on the upper deck, in the midst of a ballroom that stretched from horizon to horizon, and was domed by the bending heavens, and lighted by no meaner lamps than the stars and the magnificent moon. Dance and promenade and smoke and sing and make love and search the skies for constellations that never associate with the Big Dipper they were so tired of. And they were to see the ships of 20 navies, the customs and costumes of 20 curious peoples, the great cities of half a world. They were to hobnob with nobility and hold friendly converse with kings and princes, grand moguls, and the anointed lords of mighty empires. It was a brave conception. It was the offspring of a most ingenious brain. It was well advertised, but it hardly needed it. The bold originality, the extraordinary character, the seductive nature, and the vastness of the enterprise provoked comment everywhere and advertised it in every household in the land. Who could read the program of the excursion without longing to make one of the party? I will insert it here. It is almost as good as a map. As a text for this book, nothing could be better. Quote, "Excursion to the Holy Land, Egypt, the Crimea, Greece, and intermediate points of interest. Brooklyn, February 1, 1867. The undersigned will make an excursion, as above, during the coming season, and begs to submit to you the following program. A first-class steamer to be under his own command, and capable of accommodating at least 150 cabin passengers, will be selected, in which will be taken a select company, numbering not more than 3/4 of the ship's capacity. There is good reason to believe that this company can be easily made up in this immediate vicinity of mutual friends and acquaintances. The steamer will be provided with every necessary comfort, including library and musical instruments. An experienced physician will be on board. Leaving New York about June 1st, a middle and pleasant route will be taken across the Atlantic, and passing through the group of Azores, St. Michael will be reached in about 10 days. A day or two will be spent here, enjoying the fruit and wild scenery of these islands, and the voyage continued and Gibraltar reached in 3 or 4 days. A day or two will be spent here in looking over the wonderful subterraneous fortifications, permission to visit these galleries being readily obtained. From Gibraltar, running along the coasts of Spain and France, Marseille will be reached in 3 days. Here ample time will be given not only to look over the city, which was founded 600 years before the Christian era, and its artificial port, the finest of the kind in the Mediterranean, but to visit Paris during the Great Exhibition, and the beautiful city of Lyon, lying intermediate, from the heights of which, on a clear day, Mont Blanc and the Alps can be distinctly seen.
Okay, the subject is travel books. N'est-ce pas? And I bet you expected me to include Peter Mayle's A Year in Provence, or maybe his Hotel Pastis, or his Provence A to Z. I'm going to mix it up a bit. Yes, I'm including Peter Mayle, but let's look at a newer title, The Vintage Caper, a witty crime novel that gives you a delicious taste of Bordeaux and Provence. Hollywood lawyer Danny Roth is the victim of a world-class wine heist, and he is devastated. Sam Levitt, former corporate lawyer, wine connoisseur, and expert on cultivated crime, is called in by Roth's insurance company, now saddled with a multi-million dollar claim. His leads take him first to Bordeaux's vineyards and then to Provence. Along the way, bien sûr, he is joined by a beautiful French colleague, Sophie. In their quest to discover the truth, Sam and Sophie must explore many a chateau and its contents. The unraveling of this crime is threaded through Mayle's rendering of France's sensory delights. From the fine wines of Bordeaux to the bouillabaisse of Marseille, this is vintage Mayle. Narrator Lorelei King takes you on a magnificent audio journey.
Over the past few weeks, Roth's enjoyment as he contemplated the contents of his cellar had been less keen than usual. The problem was that apart from a very few privileged souls, nobody ever saw the bottles of Latour and Margaux and Petrus, and those who did often were not sufficiently impressed. Only last night, a visiting couple from Malibu had been given the grand tour of the cellar, $3 million worth of wine, and they hadn't even bothered to remove their sunglasses. Worse still, they had then declined the Opus 1 served with dinner and demanded iced tea. No appreciation, no respect. It was the kind of evening that could make a serious wine collector weep. Shaking his head at the memory, Roth paused on his way to the garage to admire the view. West to Beverly Hills, east to Thai Town and Little Armenia, south across the endless shimmering sprawl to the toy-sized planes that came and went from LAX. Perhaps not the prettiest of views, particularly when the smog was up, but it was a high view. A long view, an expensive view, and, best of all, his view. Mine, all mine, he sometimes thought to himself, especially at night when the lights below made a shining carpet that stretched for miles. He squirmed his way into the snug confines of his Mercedes and inhaled the perfume of well-nourished leather and polished walnut. This particular model was one of the great classic cars, so old that it predated the invention of the beverage container. And Rafael, the Mexican caretaker, looked after it as though it were a museum piece. Roth eased it out of the garage and headed for his office on Wilshire Boulevard, his mind going back to his wine cellar and that dumb couple from Malibu, whom he'd never liked anyway. From thinking about them, it was only a short mental hop to a more philosophical consideration of the joys of possession. And here Roth had to admit that the appreciation, even the envy, of others was crucial to his own enjoyment. Where, he asked himself, is the satisfaction of having desirable possessions that others hardly ever see? Why, it would be like keeping his youthful blonde wife locked away from public view, or sentencing the Mercedes to a lifetime of confinement in the garage. And yet, here he was, keeping millions of dollars' worth of the world's finest wines in a cellar that was unlikely to see more than half a dozen visitors a year. By the time he reached the tinted glass box that contained his office, Roth had come to two conclusions. First, that inconspicuous consumption was for wimps, and second, that his wine collection deserved a wider audience. He stepped out of the elevator and walked toward his corner office, bracing himself for the daily mano a mano with his executive secretary, Cecilia Volpe. Strictly speaking, she was not quite up to the job. Her spelling was lamentable, her memory frequently patchy, and her attitude toward many of Roth's clients one of patrician disdain. But there were consolations. She had the most spectacular legs, long and permanently tanned, made even longer by a seemingly inexhaustible supply of 4-inch heels. And she was the only daughter of Myron Volpe, the current head of the Volpe dynasty that had pounced upon the movie business 2 generations ago and that still maintained considerable influence behind the scenes. As Cecilia had been heard to say, the Volpes were the closest it got in Hollywood to a royal family. And so Roth tolerated her for her connections, despite her lengthy personal calls, her frequent makeup breaks, and that atrocious spelling.
Check any best of lists of favorite travel memoirs, and you'll nearly always find The Great Railway Bazaar by Paul Theroux. Filled with evocative names of legendary train routes, the Direct Orient Express, the Khyber Pass Local, the Delhi Mail from Jaipur, the Golden Arrow to Kuala Lumpur, and the Trans-Siberian Express, this classic book describes the many places, cultures, sights, and sounds Theroux experienced and the fascinating people he met. In Ghost Train to the Eastern Star, which we'll preview now, Theroux retraces the steps he took 30 years ago. From the Eurostar in London, he once again sets out on a journey to the east, traveling overland through Eastern Europe, India, and Asia. Infused with the changes that have shaped the exterior landscape and enriched with developments to his own perceptions, Ghost Train to the Eastern Star is a beautifully written next chapter in his journeys. It's read by John McDonough.
Ghost, a creepy revenant from the underworld, unobserved and watchful among real people, wandering, listening while remaining unseen. Being invisible, the usual condition of the older traveler, is much more useful than being obvious. You see more, you are not interrupted, you are ignored. Such a traveler isn't in a hurry, which is why you might mistake him for a bum. Hating schedules, depending on chance encounters, I am attracted by travel's slow tempo. Ghosts have all the time in the world, another pleasure of long-distance aimlessness, traveling at half speed on slow trains and procrastinating. And this ghostliness, I was to find, was also an effect of the journey I had chosen, returning to places I had known many years ago. It is almost impossible to return to an early scene in your traveling life and not feel like a specter. And many places I saw were themselves sad and spectral, others big and hectic, while I was the haunting presence, the eavesdropping shadow on the ghost train. Long after I took the trip I wrote about in The Great Railway Bazaar, I went on thinking how I'd gone overland, changing trains across Asia, improvising my trip, rubbing against the world, and reflecting on what I'd seen, the way the unrevisited past is always looping in your dreams. Memory is a ghost train, too. Ages later, you still ponder the beautiful face you once glimpsed in a distant country, or the sight of a noble tree, or a country road, or a happy table in a cafe, or some angry boys armed with rusty spears shrieking, "Run, you life, Dim Dim!" Or the sound of a train at night, striking that precise musical note of train whistles, a diminished third, into the darkness, as you lie in the train, moving through the world as travelers do, inside the whale.
Part foreign affairs discourse, part humor, and part twisted self-help guide, The Geography of Bliss, One Grump Search for the Happiest Places in the World, is written and narrated by Eric Weiner. The book takes the reader from America to Iceland to India in search of happiness, or, in the crabby author's case, moments of un-unhappiness. Weiner uses a mix of travel, psychology, science, and humor to investigate not what happiness is, but where it is. Are people in Switzerland happier because it's the most democratic country in the world? Do citizens of Singapore benefit psychologically by having their options limited by the government? Is the King of Bhutan a visionary for his initiative to calculate gross national happiness? And why is Asheville, North Carolina so damn happy? With engaging wit and surprising insight, the book answers those questions and offers travelers of all moods some interesting new ideas for sunnier destinations and dispositions.
My bags were packed and my provisions loaded. I was ready for adventure. And so, on a late summer afternoon, I dragged my reluctant friend Drew off to explore new worlds and, I hoped, to find some happiness along the way. I've always believed that happiness is just around the corner. The trick is finding the right corner. Not long into our journey, Drew grew nervous. He pleaded with me to turn back, but I insisted we press on, propelled by an irresistible curiosity about what lay ahead. Danger? Magic? I needed to know, and to this day I'm convinced I would have reached wherever it was I was trying to reach had the Baltimore County Police not concluded, impulsively I thought at the time, that the shoulder of a major thoroughfare was no place for a couple of five-year-olds. Some people acquire the travel bug, others are born with it. My affliction, if that's what it is, went into remission for many years following my aborted expedition with Drew. It resurfaced after college with renewed fury. I desperately wanted to see the world, preferably on someone else's dime. But how? I had no marketable skills, a stunted sense of morality, and a gloomy disposition. I decided to become a journalist. As a foreign correspondent for National Public Radio, I traveled to places such as Iraq, Afghanistan, and Indonesia, unhappy places. On one level, this made perfect sense. Unconsciously, I was observing the first law of writing— write about what you know. And so, notebook in hand, tape recorder slung over my shoulder, I roamed the world telling the stories of gloomy, unhappy people. The truth is that unhappy people living in profoundly unhappy places make for good stories. They tug at heartstrings and inspire pathos. They can also be a real bummer. What if, I wondered, I spent a year traveling the globe, seeking out not the world's well-trodden trouble spots, but rather its unheralded happy places, places that possess, in spades, one or more of the ingredients that we consider essential to the hearty stew of happiness: money, pleasure, spirituality, family, and chocolate, among others. Around the world, dozens of what-ifs play themselves out every day. What if you lived in a country that was fabulously wealthy and no one paid taxes? What if you lived in a country where failure is an option? What if you lived in a country so democratic that you voted 7 times a year? What if you lived in a country where excessive thinking is discouraged? Would you be happy then? That's exactly what I intended to find out, and the result of this admittedly harebrained experiment is the audiobook you're now listening to.
In Travels in Siberia, Ian Fraser explores many aspects of this storied, often grim region. He writes about the geography, the resources, the native people, the histories, the 40 below midwinter afternoons, and the bugs. The book brims with Mongols, half-crazed Orthodox archpriests, fur seekers, ambassadors of the Tsar bound for Peking, tea caravans, German scientists, American prospectors, and prisoners and exiles of every kind. More than just a historical travelogue, Travels in Siberia is also an account of Russia since the end of the Soviet Union, and a personal reflection on the all-round amazingness of Russia, a country that still somehow manages to be funny. The book is read by the author.
The United States, from Maine to California, stretches across four time zones. In Siberia, there are eight. The contiguous United States, plus most of Europe, could fit inside it. Across the middle of Siberia, latitudinally, for 3,600 miles, runs the Russian taiga, the largest forest in the world. The Ural Mountains, which cross Russia north to south from the Arctic Ocean to Kazakhstan, are on the western edge of Siberia. The Urals also separate Europe from Asia. As a mountain range with the big job of dividing two continents, the Urals aren't much. It is possible to drive over them, as I have done, and not know. In central Russia, the summits of the Urals average between 1,000 and 2,000 feet. But after you cross the Urals, the land opens out. The villages are farther apart, the concrete bus shelters along the highway become fewer, and suddenly you realize you're in Siberia. To the east, about 3,000 miles beyond the Urals, Siberia ends at the Pacific Ocean, in the form of the Sea of Japan, the Sea of Okhotsk, and the Bering Sea. Since Soviet times, Russians have called this part of Siberia the Russian Far East. The Arctic Ocean borders Siberia on the north. West to east, its seas are the Kara Sea, the Laptev Sea, and the East Siberian Sea. For most of the year, though less consistently than before, this line is obscured under ice. The land here, for as much as 250 miles in from the sea, is tundra, a treeless, mossy bog for a couple of months of summer, a white, near wasteland otherwise. In the south, Siberia technically ends at the border between Russia and Kazakhstan, Mongolia, and China, although Siberian watersheds and landforms continue on into them. This region is mostly steppe. The steppes of Siberia are part of the Great Eurasian Steppe, which extends from almost the Pacific westward as far as the Danube. For more than 2,000 years, the Eurasian Steppe produced nomadic barbarians who descended upon and destroyed cultivated places beyond the steppe's margins. The steppes were why China built the Great Wall. Out of the steppes in the 13th century came Genghis Khan and the Mongol hordes, civilization's then worst nightmare, the wicked stepfathers of the Russian state and of its tsars and commissars. Sakhalin Island, which almost touches the Russian coast north of Japan, is considered part of Siberia. The island was a prison colony during Tsarist times. 600 miles northeast of Sakhalin, the peninsula of Kamchatka descends from the Siberian mainland, dividing the Sea of Okhotsk from the Bering Sea. Kamchatka lies within the Pacific Rim's Ring of Fire and has active volcanoes. Kamchatka's Klyuchevskaya volcano, at 15,580 feet, is the highest point in Siberia.
Wherever you're off to this summer, I'm sure you'll pack some great books. They are amazing travel companions. Drop me a line of your favorite titles so I can share them with fellow readers. Just go to bookreportradio.com and click on Reader's Corner, or send an email to elaine@bookreportradio.com. I love hearing from you. Thanks so much for journeying with me today, and see you back here next week for The Book Report.